Yeah. Well, not exactly that, actually. Today I was thinking to speak essentially about the phase separation problem, which have been observed in the Bechgard salt, as far as we are concerned, the Bechgard salt, and then a little bit, and also in the two-dimensional organics system, and also in now more recently in the V2O3 business. So it seems to be something quite general. And but before I start the phase separation, let me talk a little bit, because that's something really extremely puzzling, the fact that, you know, we had this tour within the high temperature phase from the insulator to metal, and then the crossover from the metal, which is Luttinger-like, although it's very Mott-like here, Mott influence here. It becomes more Luttinger when you are here, and then you cross over towards a metal which looks like Fermi liquid, but as you've probably, most of you know already, it's a very exotic Fermi liquid. And then we'll really, the phase separation problem takes place here, and we spend some time here. So we'll start a little bit with the exotic Fermi liquid. Exotic in the sense that it's not a Fermi liquid or a liquid of electron in which you can describe the conductivity by the Drude law. This was already known since 1983, that the fact that when you look at the conductivity in the metallic state of the Bechgard salt, with this is the conductivity along the chains, and at 25 Kelvin, it is really a pretty good metal. The conductivity is actually showing a huge zero frequency peak, or at least a very narrow peak, and it's not even the zero value is not, cannot be put on this scale. And then there is clearly no conductivity in the infrared until you have a gap, something like a gap here, and then a decrease. The gap is of the order of 200 wave number, let's say 200 Kelvin or 170 Kelvin. And then you have a high frequency behavior, which we actually analyzed the last Tuesday as a reminiscence of the Luttinger liquid behavior at high frequency. And this is very unusual. Well, it's not that unusual if you consider the high TC as normal system, but it is something which is common with the high TC business, that the fact that the oscillator strength has been as a actual hole in the far infrared region. And of course, if you go up in temperature, you smooth everything, and even at room temperature, you have some reminiscence of this gap, but it is more spectacular, it's a low temperature. This has been revisited more recently by the group of Zurich, where they look at the conductivity, the real part of the conductivity, and again, they got something very similar to what was known in 83. It means you have, this is now a log scale for the frequency, and then you have a peak with showing that you have a gap around 1 or 200 wave number, and then you have a very, very, very strong low frequency Drude-like peak, but it's not really the proper Drude wave function. Now, it was recognized a really long time ago that if you take a Drude description of the conductivity, it doesn't work. We know the plasma frequency, the total spectral weight, this is very well known if you integrate the whole spectrum. And near 12 Kelvin, we know sigma at DC frequency. So you could actually simulate what should you expect, what can be expected in terms of conductivity in the far infrared. And this is a dotted line. If you assume that you have a very regular Drude behavior, you have the dotted line. But the experiment, this is in the perchlorate system, the experiment gives you that you have very, very little conductivity in this region, and you are forced to make the assumption that the conductivity which is removed here goes into a very narrow zero frequency peak. So you have a large DC conductivity due to the zero frequency collective mode. That was very well observed and pointed out by Tom Timusk in the 83-86. The plasma frequency given from the zeros, the zeros of a dielectric constant, would be over 500 wave number, has to be, which has to be compared with a 9 or 10,000 wave number for the plasma frequency of the whole system. So this would be the plasma frequency of the very narrow Drude mode here. The oscillator strength, actually, if you integrate sigma, the oscillator strength that you have under this very narrow, on this scale you hardly see it, is only 1% of the total oscillator strength. And it's a very, extremely, very, well, very narrow, it's a, in the microwave range, the width of this Drude peak. So you see that you are really far from having a very normal Fermi liquid in the metallic state of this system. Now, if I go to the spin sector, and it's quite interesting because the NMR is known to be very unnormal as well. This is the NMR relaxation rate, or you can see it here, of TM, the Bellegarde salt. At ambient pressure, it's known that at ambient pressure you have a spin density wave transition, so you may have precursor effect as shown here. And this behavior, the straight line, is due to the uniform the uniform fluctuation, spin fluctuation, giving rise to a contribution which goes like the temperature times the square of the susceptibility. But since at low temperature, or in this region at least, the susceptibility is practically constant in temperature, it will give you a straight line. And then you have a precursor effect. But when you are at 9 kilobar, at 9 kilobar you have removed the spin density wave state, and the ground state is superconductivity. But since you are under a field of 3 tesla, the field is actually above the critical field, so the ground state is, in that case, is a normal, it's a normal metal, you still see a bump, very important bump here, which is actually very much pressure dependent. It is pressure dependent. And this is the same behavior that you have on the perchlorate system, the one which becomes superconducting without any pressure. So the 1 bar experiment here is equivalent to the 9 kilobar experiment on the PF6. It was this T1 anomaly in the range of 30 Kelvin was actually first attributed to a dimensional crossover. That was the story with Claude Bourbonnais. And if you do a perturbative approach with the renormalization group theory of the T star, the crossover from 1D to 2D, this would be the kind of formula that you could expect, where alpha is the exponent of the quasi-particle density of state, and then would provide everything with a K-rho of 0.23, would give you a T star actually of the order of 2 or 3 Kelvin, and that's clearly a little bit stupid because we know from transport that we saw on Tuesday, and we also know from optics, you know, the transverse plasma edge and things like that, that the crossover should be located at a much higher temperature of the order of 100 Kelvin. So probably this abnormal behavior cannot be attributed to a crossover where you will have actually a Fermi liquid at very low temperature and a non-Fermi liquid at high temperature. So we should look for something else. And this is actually an open question. I'm not claiming that I know the answer. It's just a question maybe which has to be solved by theoretician a little bit later. But I wish to point out that Silke Biermann and Antoine Jorb, they could simulate by the DMFT techniques, they could simulate the existence in the case of half field band model of a very narrow peak at zero frequency, at low frequency, and then they still have reminiscence. It's for different value of U, I suppose. They have still reminiscence of the mod gap in this metallic state. So you have a mod gap plus a draw peak with actually a tiny weight. And in that case, the Fermi surface is going to look at low temperature like small pockets of holes, small pocket of electrons. It's a compensated material. So it's like as if you had a doped, insulator. The doping is actually the in-situ doping due to the warping of the Fermi surface. I'm very pleased. I understand that the theoreticians are not that pleased with that picture, but I'm actually rather pleased because it gives the good curvature here for the Fermi surface. And in fact, it would explain the famous Dana-Chaikin oscillation seen in the magnetoresistance when you tilt the magnetic field. But okay, it shows that maybe there is something true in the picture, although it should be done for the quarter field band system and not the half field. But maybe this is also the source. These small pockets actually could actually possibly be related to the anomaly of T1. Here I have replotted the low temperature data. So this is the actual data. And you have two contributions. You have the T chi square contribution due to the uniform fluctuation. And then you have the additional contribution. So if you remove the T chi square, you get the red curve, the red points, which I would like to call it Drude relaxation, because in my mind I thought maybe there is some relation between the growth of the very narrow Drude peak and the existence of this extra relaxation. The idea is actually something like, I would like to borrow this idea from Thierry Jamarchi's work, where he considers the fact that the crossover to the Fermi liquid amounts to an in-situ doping. In case you have a pure, this is a description of a regular semiconductor, and in case you have a pure MOT insulator, you have actually no excitation in the upper level, but this amount, these excitations which are shown here above the gap, the MOT gap, would actually be soliton-like excitation, and they are due to the fact that you have some warping of the surface, or you have some pockets of holes or pockets of electrons which becomes relevant. And in fact, you should have pockets of electron and also pockets of hole, because it's everything is neutral. So this is, you have some kind of excitation, soliton-like, and I would like to suggest, but maybe that's completely wrong, and certainly there is no theory there yet, that the motion of this excitation, they will have a certain lifetime, this excitation, and by the hyperfine interaction to the nuclear, they could actually relax the nuclear spin and give rise to a process which is very similar to the relaxation in semiconductors, a very old thing when you have electrons excited for a gap and they relax the nuclear spin, and they will actually give rise to there is a lifetime of the excitation, which is a correlation time, and then also T to the 1/2, which is due to the Boltzmann factor. And actually, this is maybe not too bad, because roughly speaking, you see this behavior. Well, you have the onset, which is due to the, let's say, the growth of the Drude peak. And then at low temperature, when it's saturated, you have the Boltzmann factor, which is playing some role. This could be attributed to the T to the 1/2 flow. But let's just, I tell you that just because I want to point out that there is a problem, an interesting problem, possibly, just with the NMR, to study the NMR. Now, you have seen that this Fermi liquid from which we get superconductivity is very exotic. So now I want to touch a little bit the case of the three cases of when you have phase segregation. And now I think it's well accepted, and actually I was yesterday in UCLA, and they got, by different techniques, exactly, they got to the same conclusion, So I'm going to talk about the TM2X phase diagram, showing phase segregation. Quite a lot of people have been involved because we have also done similar work a little bit earlier, actually, on the two-dimensional organics, and more recently in the V2O3. So it's quite a general behavior, this phase segregation. We pay attention to this curve in red. The canonical picture in, 22 years ago, was the following. Is that here in red, we have a first order transition, and then we have re-entrant superconductivity. From the very early days of this superconductivity, we were fascinated by the fact that you have a common border between an antiferromagnetic insulating state, let's say the spin density wave state, which is insulating, and superconductivity. There is a common border, and the transition that we had seen earlier was extremely sharp when you set the pressure at the right value and then you sweep the temperature. We got a very, very sharp superconducting transition, and that we thought it was a first order, and actually probably it is first order, but it's a little bit more complicated. And recently, doing very patient work, thanks to a very nice, helpful physics student coming from Zagreb, we have revisited this border very patiently. I mean, he was able to do 19 runs, pressure run, just slicing the pressure, the range, every, let's say, every 200 bar, and keeping the same sample. I don't want to spend time on these technical tricks, but all these experiments are not that easy, and it is much more valuable if you are able to do several runs keeping the same sample, because you don't have to worry about the geometry of the different geometry of the sample and so on. So it's much better than doing.
Is it constant pressure?
It is constant pressure, and this is the resistivity curve versus temperature, resistivity in log versus temperature. Starting from the low pressure range, so the low pressure range here, you get the traditional behavior, it becomes insulating. And as you increase pressure, you can see as from this pressure, which is here, you begin to see a small anomaly at the temperature of 1 Kelvin. And then as you increase pressure further, you still see the anomaly, but the resistivity is dropping more. And then finally, it's only under 11 kilobar that you can see a regular superconducting behavior, or the metallic behavior, which is followed by superconductivity. I'm sorry for the log scale, because it's not good to plot superconductivity on a log scale, as we have heard. And it should do on a linear scale, because we don't see where the zero of the resistivity is. But at least it's just to point out that there is an insulating behavior first, and then there is an anomaly, and always at the same temperature. Okay, this is the sharpness of the transition. It's not so important. And finally, I just give you the final phase diagram that we reach, and then I will tell you how we can make this phase diagram. The phase diagram, here in the insert, you have the general phase diagram, that you have a spin density wave state which is depressed, suppressed by pressure, and then finally at high pressure you have a superconducting state. But then you have this anomaly in a narrow pressure range. You have, and here it's a blow up of this range. You have and some resistivity anomaly, a drop of the resistivity, which always takes place at the same temperature. This is actually pressure independent, whereas if you are looking here at this superconductivity, the TC is pressure dependent. The TC is slightly moving. Well, if you go to 30 kilobar, you will see it easily, that it's slightly depressed under pressure in the homogeneous domain, whereas TC is staying constant in this region of the diagram. So our final interpretation is the following, that here, as you pass the line here, there is a region where you have a coexistence of an antiferromagnetic insulating state coexisting macroscopically, not microscopically, but macroscopically with a metallic state. And the metallic state, the region which are metallic, in turn become superconducting when you load lower temperature. So you know, sorry?
How do you know that it's microscopic and not microscopic?
Okay, this is exactly what I'm going to start now. The way we can tell that is actually the following. We were studying the activation plot of the resistivity when you increase pressure, and this is a behavior. Here at high temperature it is a metallic behavior, and then you have the transition, and it's a rather traditional. At low pressure you have a traditional activation plot because it's semiconducting, but then you begin to see on this 1 over T plot, you begin to see this anomaly. You have first the activation, and then you have the anomaly, and so on, until you get superconductivity. So we just made a model assuming that in this region, as you can see here, the intercept, as long as you are you have a good insulator at low pressure, the infinite temperature intercept here is the same. But as actually you increase pressure, and you are entering the narrow pressure regime close to the critical pressure, which is of the order of a little bit above let's say around 10 kilobar, you see that the intercept here at zero, at infinite temperature, begins to move down. So we used a very simple model, at least which seems to work. We take the model that we have in parallel. In the sample, we have filaments or macroscopic filaments, where in parallel we have insulating filaments and metallic domains in parallel, which means that when you measure the total resistivity, you have to add the conductivity weighted by the volume fraction C, which is a volume fraction of the metal. So this is a kind of formula, very simple formula that we are using in order to fit all this data, and then we could get what is the volume fraction of the metal under pressure. As you see, when you are at high pressure, the volume fraction is, the system is an homogeneous metal, and you get 100% metal. But as soon as you decrease the pressure here below the critical pressure, you see that the volume fraction is actually can decrease, this is 10%, and even lower value could be reached.
How do you extract the measure, just from the resistivity?
We just fit all this thing by this simple law, and knowing the gap, which, okay, known from the activated region. And this is how we get the volume fraction versus pressure. But I have an...
In practice, you will need to put in something for RM and air.
Yeah, RM is actually known from the higher temperature regime. The metallic resistivity is known from just above TC. We just have we suppose that it is, we keep the same metallic behavior as we have above TC.
And for the other guy, it takes some activation law.
Well, that's measured. This is what it is measured. The activation is not some. It is the one which is measured.
Yeah, but if the metallic fraction is below percolation, then why?
Well, I think that's a real good question, because we don't think that we are facing a problem of percolation. We think that we are facing a problem of raw spaghetti, in a sense that they are actually, the spaghetti, and this is a very good question, because I think this is where the whole problem lies. We don't think that we are in the one-dimensional material, and it's maybe the thing could be quite different. Okay. But it's precisely the problem. The percolation may not be relevant here. I show you one other experiment, which is again pointing towards the model of the raw spaghetti, is that when you are at high pressure in the homogeneous state, and if you look at you look at the superconducting properties, this is a V versus I characteristic, and this is typically at the lowest temperature. So then this value of 45 milliamps, which is located here, could be linked to the critical current for superconductivity. This is a critical current experiment. We destroy superconductivity by applying a large current in zero field, zero magnetic field. And then we have a density, we have a critical current of 45 milliamps. We know the geometry of the sample, so we go back to the density, the critical current density, 200 amps per square centimeter, which is quite normal for this poor superconductor. And then above the value, when the current is above 45, we recover the Ohm's law with a normal state resistance, which actually this is the back to the question of Antoine. We recover the resistance of the metallic state. So that's quite okay, the resistance 1.2 milliohm. Normal state is recovered. Now, when you go to the lower pressure range, 9.1 kilobar, so you are below the critical pressure, you still see superconductivity, as in a curve like V versus I, you still see superconductivity, but the critical current is actually much lower. It's the same sample, the same geometry. The critical current is 7 milliamps and only a fraction, let's say you can think in terms of only a fraction of the cross section, let's say, no, not even 1/10, 1/8 of the cross section is actually still remaining superconducting. Otherwise, you recover at high temperature, what you recover is actually a normal state resistivity, which is much larger than the metallic one, because what you recover is you recover the spin density wave one. What you recover in a normal state is actually much less than the spin density wave one, because in that case, when you are at high current, you also have a large electric field, and your spin density wave state is in the sliding regime, because E over E threshold is of the order of 5. So, which is much, then what you recover is not a normal metallic state, but you recover a sliding spin density wave state. So, this critical current experiment in the superconducting state is for us suggesting that what you are in the low pressure regime, in the so called phase segregation domain, you have only a small fraction of the total cross section, which is remaining metallic and then becoming superconducting. That was a rather simple picture. In that case, there is no percolation, because one spaghetti goes from one end until the other end without break. And roughly speaking, it would go like that. It's just a problem of cross section. A model that we could use for that is actually extremely naive. That actually, if you plot the spin density wave condensation energy versus the lattice parameter, or it's somewhat related to the pressure, it is that at a given pressure, at a given volume, well, you have a spin density wave would be stable because just the condensation energy is negative. And then above, you would reach a critical pressure where the spin density wave will no longer be favorable, and then you keep the metallic state. But you have to realize that because of the curvature of this spin density wave condensation energy, which has been in the early days calculated by a lot of people, and in particular by Yamaji, that at a certain volume, it is actually better for the sample to make a demixion of, to go one, some part of the sample will go to a lattice constant, which is larger, so the large, so A plus epsilon, whereas other part will actually go to A minus epsilon. You will gain in energy by making spin density wave and metal segregation will give a lower energy, lower than the homogeneous phase, and especially in the vicinity of the border. So we'll show that in a second, a little bit more in more detail. So this is the, in green, this is the condensation energy of the homogeneous speed density wave state reaching zero at a certain lattice constant. But if you allow for demiction between between a spin density wave state and a metallic state, you can lower the overall energy. So it's actually, this is the, what the system should do, is to go to the lowest possible energy, and then the demiction would be more favorable than homogeneous state. This is just a simple argument on just based on thermodynamics.
What is U?
U is a lattice constant. Now, if you can do that using a little bit more elaborated theory, if you use the theory of the spin density wave, the stability under pressure, the theory which has been developed by a lot of people, Yamaji, by Héritier, Lederer, and probably others. If you calculate the total, the free energy, the total free energy, and if you allow for some distortion, you see you have actually the two contributions. You have to add the, let's say, the elastic the free energy related to the elastic distortion, and then this is a free energy due to the spin density wave condensation, the magnetic one. And if actually you have this is the lattice variation of the lattice constant, and this is C is in the metal and in the insulator. C is the volume fraction of the metal. So what you have is you have a gain. Of course, if you let's say if you expand the lattice, you have a gain of magnetic energy, which goes like that. TB prime being the transverse coupling, the warping, and delta B is a lattice is a change of the lattice constant. But as you are straining your material, you have a loss of elastic energy, which, as usual, should go like the square of the lattice displacement. So you have to add both, and you minimize with respect to C and the variation of lattice constant, and then you get a domain of stability where it is better to have actually a certain domain of stability in terms of the parameter TB prime, where instead of having the homogeneous spin density wave state, which is shown here in blue, and then will go all the way down here with the critical value of TB prime, in this region, you have better, in terms of thermodynamics, to have a demiction of the system into regions which are located, when you are at this value of TB prime, it's better to have regions which are much smaller, smaller value of TB prime, coexisting with regions which are higher, much larger value of TB prime. This is, so in a sense, you have here, you will have a tricritical point, because then this region is actually the region of first order transition where you have a demiction into. It's a little bit similar to a liquid gas problem. Then the metallic, so the competition is actually between spin density wave and the metal, and it's only the part of the sample which are metallic, which in turn becomes superconducting at low temperature. If you add the superconducting condensation energy, it's just going to increase here a little bit the region of coexistence. It makes the coexistence a little bit broader in pressure. But otherwise, the main competition is between antiferromagnetism and metal. And then you should keep the TC in this picture. The TC would be constant because the superconducting region will always have the value of TB prime, which is here TB prime 2. So this is again in agreement with the fact that experimentally we find that in this region TC is constant. Why we lose superconductivity here, it's not because TC is decreasing, TC is constant, but the volume fraction of superconductor is very sharply decreasing to zero when we go through this demiction region. This is the reason why we lose superconductivity.
I think I missed the point. Has there been Do you have direct measurement of the hysteresis?
No, we don't, because that's a problem of this is essentially a technical problem, that it is not possible at such high at this high pressure to do constant. We are forced to do that. Actually, I got, but you are going to have him here, Stuart Brown at UCLA. So this every or the whole picture here is based on transport data, as you have seen, and also superconductivity measurement. But recently, he will probably tell you that he has very nice NMR data, Stuart, that in this region, where he can show coexistence on a macroscopic scale of region which give the NMR signal of the metallic part and region which give the NMR signal of the antiferromagnetic part. This is really coexisting on the spectra. I think, well, I like it very much because it's really a real confirmation that the transport data were probably okay. And we have really facing interesting problem of tricritical point, first order line, but the first order line is actually giving rise to this segregation business.
Your theoretical argument that you gain energy by the SPV when extending the lattice is for weak coupling, right?
It's for weak coupling. No, it's a weak coupling. The SDV theory is a weak coupling theory. I just want to point out that in terms of history, this phenomenon was discovered not with the compound which I've shown right now, which is a Bechgar salt, which becomes superconducting at 9 kilobar, but it was already there in another compound, the one which becomes superconducting, the Faber salt, the sulfur salt, which you need actually five gigapascal to make it superconducting, because then it is so incompressible or weakly compressible that you can see this phenomena on a much broader pressure scale. You see, this is actually the early data which for us triggered the investigation of the Bechgar salt, is that the resistivity, even at 4.5 kilobar, this is you have an upturn here, and then you have this anomaly going down, but to a finite value, because probably the current of the measurement was above the critical current for superconductivity, but only when you decrease pressure, finally, I'm sorry, this is just the opposite. I take from the high pressure side, you have a normal behavior with a resistivity going to zero, or let's say assuming zero on the log scale. And then when you decrease pressure, you see the beginning of an upturn, and then still an anomaly at the same temperature, because when you decrease pressure, you enter the coexistence regime, which is shown here. You know, this is 4 gigapascal here. So in a sense, this diagram was still influenced by our early thinking. Now we should have a phase segregation regime in this. But it was much easier to see it on this compound because it extended over 10 kilobar range, 10 kilobar pressure width. In Bechgar salt, it's only 1 kilobar. So, but I wanted to mention this compound because there is a very interesting discussion, let's say, among specialists maybe, is the fact that the critical field to kill superconductivity is actually could be found extremely large. This critical field, when you put the field along the C direction, where you expect the lowest critical field. The C direction is a very weak coupling direction. So we had measured this critical field precisely in this Faber salt, the critical field versus pressure. At high pressure, you see that at high pressure, the critical field is quite normal. It's a very low value. This is what you expect in the Bechgar salt, as well as the perchlorate salt. But as you decrease pressure and you are entering this region of coexistence, segregation region, the critical field is increasing tremendously and can be 10 times the critical field of a homogeneous region. And we think that this increase of critical field, and it is actually even above the Pauli limit, and this is a little bit worrying, that such large critical field, this is 1 Tesla for a superconductor at 1 Kelvin, so it's going to be above the Pauli limit. And one possibility, but you know, I cannot be absolutely, nothing is sure, it's just a suggestion, that when you are in this region, actually you have, now this was a spaghetti model, the spaghetti are actually slabs which remain superconducting, and actually only a small cross-section of the sample is superconducting in the coexistence regime, and in between you have, you keep the insulating domain, so a magnetic field which is, let's say, parallel to the slab here, the magnetic field can always go through, and possibly then you could have, you could pass a very large magnetic field which is, okay, maybe, but there is still no theory for that. It's an interesting geometry to study, that you could maybe go reach critical field which are much larger. Let's say the critical field for the whole sample could be actually much larger than the critical field of the individual slabs. But still, this is a suggestion and something which could be studied, because the reason is the following, that the large critical field has been taken by colleagues as an evidence of triplet pairing in this material for superconductivity. And I would before accepting this idea, I would be very happy if we could model this behavior of the segregated material under high field, because maybe no triplet pairing is needed to explain the large critical field close to this border. It's just a problem of a geometrical effect that you can pass a lot of field in between the superconducting region. It's a bit strange, you know. And this critical field is even above the Pauli limit. So this is a reason why some colleagues just attributed to the very large critical field the fact that you don't destroy superconductivity and that you have triplet pairing. But it would be very strange to have a phase which is antiferromagnetic, close to a superconducting state, and yet have a triplet pairing. So that's still, you know, the nature of superconductivity in these organics is still unknown. Well, this phase segregation has been observed recently also in other material, TTF2, BF4, so that's the same story again. So you have an upturn, you have a drop of the resistivity. And also we've studied the critical current. The critical current, as you see, the critical current versus pressure. At low pressure, you have a pure spin density wave, so you have no critical current because you have no superconductivity. And as you increase pressure, the system becomes richer and richer and in superconducting region, so you increase the critical current at a given temperature. So it shows that within the organics, it's a very general behavior. And even among the two-dimensional material, these are the two-dimensional organics, so-called the BEDT, so you have layers of molecule, and you have very highly conducting planes, which are separated from each other by insulating planes, and they form a very interesting, they give rise to a very interesting phase diagram. First of all, the TC for superconductivity is 10 times larger than for the Bechgard salt, so it's more comfortable to work with. And there is a phase diagram which was first studied by Sylvie Lefebvre in our group together with the group of Sherbrooke. And recently there is a new piece of work done by acoustic attenuation by Poirier in Sherbrooke, who reach very similar conclusion as far as this phase diagram, which is essentially you have a paramagnetic insulator becoming metallic with a MOT line which is terminating probably at a critical point which is not so easy to locate. The paramagnetic insulator is becoming antiferromagnetic, it's ordering, and the metal is becoming a uniform superconductor. But in between here, Sylvie Lefebvre could detect that you have a phase here, you have a region where you clearly have, from NMR and from susceptibility measurement, you have a coexistence of antiferromagnetic domains with superconductivity on a macroscopic scale here. And probably this lower part of the phase diagram is wrong. I would say that this coexistence regime is extending down to zero pressure, probably. So this is again showing that this coexistence seems to be very general, at least among the organics. Whenever you have an antiferromagnetic insulating state neighboring superconducting state, you have a region of coexistence in a certain pressure range.
So do you expect coexistence between antiferromagnetic and superconductor, or between antiferromagnet and metal?
In that case, we have coexistence between antiferromagnetic and superconductor.
All the way down to zero?
On the way down to zero pressure, because although we did this kind of work, but now we could detect, when we work at zero pressure and we measure the transverse resistivity, we detect a small anomaly of the resistance which does not go all the way to zero, but at the temperature of 12 Kelvin. Yeah, there is something, probably. So this is why I think the coexistence is there, but even broader, on a broader scale than what I've shown on this slide.
Do you know how large is the gap in the
antiferromagnet?
Do you have any idea?
Well, in the antiferromagnet, well, you could tell roughly from the 20 Kelvin, the critical temperature.
Let's see. Not necessarily.
No.
How about activation?
No, I don't.
You measure the...
No, because it's insulator. You do.
Yeah, you can get from the activation.
Yeah, but here what you could get is the gap that you have in the MOT state here.
Uh-huh.
But then you see nothing when you pass the transition from transport. Yeah, you have to do susceptibility work.
Okay.
Yeah, you cannot make, it doesn't make any difference whether you are here or here. It's just a continuation of the line.
Thank you.
So you cannot. So. Just now, there is just a few minutes left to talk about V203, but before I switch to V203, I hope I convinced you, but this salt has been around for a lot of time, that they are probably, according to Paul Chaiking, the most interesting material ever discovered. This is Paul Chaiking who claimed that. And I would think that I would add something that not only the Bechgar salt, but I think also the all organics are extremely interesting. And now, since this is really with very profound words, I switch to V203 for a few minutes. The well-known phase diagram. This is actually interesting because, historically speaking, we have been working in 203 25 years ago. At the same time, Maurice Weiss, Denis McQuaid were interested in V203. And this is how I got interested in V203, is for Maurice Weiss. And we did some work, an NMR, in pure V203, this is a chromium doping or pressure scale. And then in red, this is the famous MOT line that the student in our group is still studying using chromium dope. But this is not what I'm going to discuss today. Insulating part, metallic part, and antiferromagnetic insulating state, which I don't understand in terms of theory, so maybe here there is people understanding it, but I don't. But we already noticed the slide is extremely bad. We noticed that in the high pressure regime, we have a very strange phase here, behavior, and we called it, well, it's, you can hardly see it, we called it a semi-metal. That was already what we had about 25 years ago. So we decided to go back to that because of the phase segregation which was observed in the organics. And we did several, really, again, we have been lucky a little bit with the runs. This is pure V203. Let's say we start from the high pressure regime. High pressure regime, you get a very clean 24 kilobar clean resistivity behavior, which is terminating with a T-square low at low temperature. Nothing too much to say about that. There is a T-square law, and this is not unexpected because you have probably strong correlation in that system. As you decrease pressure at 22.3 kilobar, the resistivity, this is the brownish curve here, is jumping up by two orders of magnitude and then leveling and then going down again. And the going down, as you increase pressure further, you push this, the upturn of the resistivity goes to higher temperature. And if actually you take the 22 kilobar curve, or let's say this one, and you plot it on a linear scale, resistance versus temperature, you see, so this was the big increase of resistance. So I plot this part here on the linear scale, I get a T-square law. So it's a metallic behavior. Although the absolute value of the resistivity is 10 times or 100 times larger than what you had in the ordinary metallic behavior at higher pressure. So you it's mean that you have certainly some part of your sample are remaining metallic and they exhibit a T-square law as well. So what we did, we thought that we had the same story as for the organics, a phase separation problem. And you see, when you decrease pressure further, finally below 14 kilobar, 13 kilobar, you no longer get this metallic behavior. It remains rather reasonable metal. You have jumps in the resistance because sometimes, you know, the crystal is cracking or things like that, but this is not affecting the data significantly. So you have clearly a narrow pressure regime where you see a metallic behavior at low temperature. So what we did is actually we pay attention to the T-square law. T-square law of the resistivity in homogeneous metallic regime at high pressure. And we are using the T-square law. And what we notice is that the T-square law, the coefficient, yeah, it's a very bad slide, but you will see that the coefficient of the T-square law is actually essentially pressure independent. Don't go to very low pressure where actually we are, these are the data from other workers, and they probably did not realize that they were entering the phase segregation regime. But as long as you are in the homogeneous state, up to 30 kilobar down to 22 kilobar, the T-square law contribution is actually very weakly pressure dependent. There is nothing like a divergence when you approach the antiferromagnetic state. So we assume that you could expand this T-square law to lower pressure, the lower pressure regime, and that the RA factor would be rather similar. And actually what we see is that the RA is actually jumping when you go to a critical pressure, jumping up, and also the residual resistance is jumping up. But entering the antiferromagnetic phase, R0 is increasing six times more than RA. But using this jump in the T-square law, we could then tell what is the volume fraction of the, make a guess about the volume fraction of the metal which remains metallic at low pressure. Because we are using this T-square law just to calibrate. You understand, probably.
What is the highest pressure in the top panel? In
the highest pressure that we've reached. We have reached 30 kilobar, but Macquan at Bell Lab in the early days had reached 45 or 50 kilobar. Essentially, there is no strong pressure dependence of the T-square law, which is not so surprising because you are very far from the Mott line. So I don't understand really what this antiferromagnetic state at low temperature is, but it's not the Mott transition. The Mott transition is far away, so you would not expect any divergence of the T-square law in this pressure regime. So that's very convenient for us because it means that you can use the T-square behavior to calibrate the volume fraction. And the fact that R0 is actually increasing more than RA when you decrease, we think that it is because you have thin walls which remain metallic, and in that case maybe these thin walls will become very much like a one-dimensional problem More sensitive to impurities, so that could be the reason why R naught is increasing more than RA when you enter the coexistence regime. One thing that we checked, and I think it is important, is that we checked that when you are in the low temperature, in the low pressure regime, then when you are here, we've checked that the characteristic, RV characteristic, is linear. So it's something ohmic. And it's not, no, we would think that if we had to face a percolation problem in that case, that if you had, you have chains, interrupted chain, metallic chain, we would think a non-ohmic characteristic. But we could go to rather high current, and we, in this region, we always find an ohmic characteristic. So our picture would be that we have transport is ohmic in the inhomogeneous state, and would mean that the metallic paths are not interrupted by barriers or by junction. Our picture that we, coming from experiment, would be the following. So you have one end of the sample and the other end of the sample. This is a picture of how the current will flow through walls which are metallic walls, and in between, which are just isolating in between large insulating domain. And the volume proportion is huge, actually. It's one out of 1,000. It's really 0.1% is metallic, remaining metallic, whereas the rest of the sample is insulating. So if you do that at different, so this is just a cartoon of what we think is the system. But important point is that you have, these are connected, all this path, actually they go all the way down to the other electrodes. So it's a connected regime. So now, the picture that we could give now for V203 is the following. Given by the experiment, you have, okay, this is only by, probably by cooling that we have here, because there is some hysteresis when you pass the transition, because it's, again, this transition is first order. But as you reach the pressure regime of 18 kilobar up to 24 kilobar, above it, it's clean metallic state. But here, there is a regime where you have, segregation between metallic domain and antiferromagnetism. Actually, there exists a little bit old work of Takigawa by NMR, where he had observed this behavior by NMR, where again, he could see even though it was he was working at a lower pressure lower than the critical pressure, he could still see the NMR of the metallic phase, of the metallic state. So again, it is also supporting the fact that you have, he was actually working in this coexistence regime. So this is, for the inorganic material, a new case.
How should I understand this rigid line that you put at 18?
I think it's the cartoon. This is, I think, the way we understand is that when you work below 18 kilobar, you don't get any sign of metallic behavior at low temperature. It's just the slope. You get the slope is zero at this 18, and then when you are above 18, then it's insulating. Below 18, it's insulating. Above 18, it's becoming metallic at low temperature. That's all.
I see, but is this really the...
It may be like that. You know, it could be like that. You know, I don't know. But there is a very broad pressure regime in which you have the coexistence. Just, I am going to disappoint you, but there is no superconductivity in the metallic state down to 50 millik. That's life. One of very few material where you have no superconductivity and yet antiferromagnetism, but that's the case. So let me summarize now. It's today we essentially, well, besides the very exotic familiki that we have in the Bechgar salt, I think we have now from the experimental point of view, we have evidence two cases where you have phase coexistence between antiferromagnetic insulating states and metal. Metal could become eventually superconductor. And just a warning that we have to be extremely careful when we study superconductivity in that case to be away from the coexistence regime, but because we have seen that the coexistence regime may disturb quite a lot the critical field which is measured. So it's a warning for us actually. It's to stay away from the coexistence regime. The coexistence regime in it by itself is interesting, but it may not be the best location in the phase diagram to study superconductivity. And this coexistence, phase coexistence, seems really to be a phenomenon which is quite general, since it is seen in the two-dimensional organics. It is also now seen in V2O3. And I guess there is also a sign of this coexistence regime in the heavy fermion material. So it's a very general system when you have a common border between antiferromagnetism and metallic state. So I thank you very much. About in V2O3?
Yeah.
I understand nothing about that. I never paid attention to this phase, essentially because as an experimentalist, when you want to measure this phase, you have sample cracking most of the time. So it's not so pleasant to study this phase and not so easy because you have a big volume contraction when you pass through the transition, the 150 Kelvin transition. I don't know. Is it an orbital? It's an orbital transition as well. I am not sure it matters so much for the problem of segregation. If you treat the segregation problem on the basis of the thermodynamics, does it matter what the macroscopic mechanism which give rise to this? Insulating state, I'm not sure, but I'm sure this has not been studied so much, you know, this antiferromagnetic state. And one thing which I did not point out today, but the metallic state of V2O3 at low temperature, again, but that was much too early when we saw that, it was 25 years ago, we pointed out in a thesis that there is a spin gap below 40 Kelvin in V2O3. But the notion, the idea of spin gap was much too early before the high TCs. So actually we didn't pay attention to that. But there is a spin gap in the V2O3 metallic state below 40 Kelvin. It was detected by night shift measurement under pressure. So they are strongly correlated material. A big T square law is large as well.
Phase separation between antiferromagnetism and other phases naturally arises also if you have doping in the system. So in particular in these situations when your metallic phase is only of very low concentration, how sure can you be that not some impurities or so dope the system so that due to different electron concentrations you have phase?
You are talking about V2O3 now. Because the Bessgar salt, it's systems. No, in the organics, we cannot expect, really, they are extremely pure material. I would not see, they will, you cannot make a crystal if you want to dope it. The crystal will not grow. So the only thing that you could have is self-doping by the picture which I've shown where you have this warping of the Fermi surface, so you have a small pockets of holes, small pocket of electrons. This is, I would say, self-doping. It is the reason why you have this system becomes two dimensional at low temperature, but not doping by impurities. I couldn't. Okay, maybe V2O3, that's another story, because there is possibility oxygen, and that's a possibility. But you see, we have been the first one to study carefully this phase region. But if you read in the literature, the work by Carter, and you see these effects, they are in between the lines, they are there. But they never, probably they were not patient enough to do the slicing in pressure as we did, and to be rather systematic. But it's really not really new, experimentally speaking, this existence of metallic phases within the antiferromagnetic ground state. I wish we can, microscopic, yes. I think the ideal experiment to do, and I hope I could talk to and possibly even convince that the ILL people to do X-ray under high pressure, or neutron work under high pressure. We need a big push of the theoretician to do that as well, but that would certainly be helpful. One thing we could do, and we'll possibly do it, I hope we can do it, is to do NMR, systematic NMR investigation, because the antiferromagnetic part is lost in the NMR signal, because the NMR signal goes away because of the local field. So we are left with the signal with which we are left is a signal coming from the metallic region. But I totally agree that what is important, would be very important, is to know the microscopic texture of this material. Is there anything to do related to the stripe model or something like that? You know, that's an open question. I just wanted to stay on the lowest experimental level and show that this exists, and this seems to be everywhere in one, when you have two neighbors, one being an antiferromagnetic insulator and the other being a metal, they mix in certain range of parameters, they mix.